Good evening. Good evening. Well, we talked about generosity last week and how generosity comes about, the very first paramita and the very first of the guidances, I guess you could say, of the guidance that starts out with generosity as the way to open up one's own mind and also the mind of others. It works both ways. Receiving someone's generosity and becoming a generous oneself creates a kind of chemical change in the mind, in the brain, that creates a situation of safety and ease. It's sometimes scary to give. It's breaking the self-protection that we build up around ourselves. It's actually cutting through and agreeing with ourselves that we don't need to protect ourselves at this moment. We open up, give it away, give our own self-protection away. So, the basis of all of this is about the bodhisattva practice. That's what the paramitas are about. And bodhicitta, which is enlightenment mind. Bodhi meaning enlightenment and citta meaning mind. And so these are ways of developing the mind of enlightenment, you could say. Or awakening, which is how he uses it. The mind of awakening. What is it that wakes us up? How can we help others to wake up? So these are very wonderful guidances that start out with pain, the painful knowledge of how things are as being a live human animal, doomed to live a very short time and then pass away. Knowing this, Chogyam says, creates a soft spot in us. If we allow ourselves to admit and acknowledge the precariousness and the mysteriousness of our life, that creates a sense of a soft is a very good way of saying it, a soft spot in us. And so the very first thing is these reminders, these four reminders, that allow us to stay soft enough to be able to do the very first thing, which is to be generous. So I wonder what you took away with this last week, and how it is with you to meet with this possibility and also meet with the difficulty of behaving, acting, doing this dance, this paramita dance of generosity. Did it follow you around, or did you just totally forget it? Wendy?
I was kind of depressed this weekend because I wanted to hear from a certain relative and I didn't. And so I was thinking, I wonder if this is the soft spot Angie's talking about. You know, that when you love somebody, you are vulnerable.
Yes.
And things don't go the way you want.
Mm.
It's painful.
It is. It is. That's the last of the four, is that suffering happens. Our suffering and the suffering of others. And we, if we don't admit that and accept that, we suffer even more. So it gives you your humanness, that soft spot, and gives you a way to be with other people, because they too are disappointed and hurting in some way.
Wondering about something, the idea of generosity and feeling like we have enough, it seems very true to me, or that it's important, it's what allows us to help other people. Mm-hmm. But then I was also, though, just in a more everyday world, it seems like it's important to have appropriate boundaries.
Yes.
When to not.
Yes.
I don't know, and so it seems like a little bit of a tricky business.
It takes close attention. And that's a really good point, because people, we all get caught up in the bodhisattva ideal and think that you should give away all of it. There's that old story of Saint Bridget, who was so caught by this sense of generosity, she just gave away everything that she had, and then her father drew the line with her. He took her aside and said, "Bridget, you're very generous and you're a lovely woman, but don't give my shoes away." So, of course, there's a limit. And knowing that is a part of the process of it, of knowing, keeping things in balance. So I think my teacher was a little off balance that way sometimes, in both ways. Sometimes he would take something from somebody's house that he really liked and never gave it back. thank you very much. And sometimes he just gave away everything he had. I was with him once in an airport, and somebody came up to him and begged him for some, you know, something. And he just emptied his pockets for this guy. So I think in both senses, he just didn't have boundaries that would have made his life much less difficult. But in a way, it was a kind of example for us to see what that, how that works, so that you can't go too far, but you don't want to not go there either. So it takes paying real close attention to each situation. Yeah, good point.
Thanks for talking about it.
Yeah. Samia?
Did he know that his boundaries were kind of shaky?
I'm not sure he did. He was the youngest of five children, and adored by everyone. He was that darling child, that special child who was so brilliant and so sensitive and so a little bit different from everybody else. And so I think he was spoiled. And it showed in the way that he operated his life, or did not operate his life. He just didn't have that much sense of what the boundaries were. And I think he just he was always wondering what the mind of Buddha was. What is Buddha's mind? And I think he was trying to figure out how Buddha lived and how he could live that way too. And I think we're all asking the same question. How can we do that? How can we live the way Jesus lived? That there's some way to live that includes this softness, this kindness, this this way of loving. We don't talk about these things so much, and we feel like there are two levels. There's just the level of the everyday harsh reality of disappointments and pain, and then this other ideal, which we have to see and have in some way to compare ourselves to, hold ourselves up to, as a kind of not as a way of judgment, but a way of understanding what the possibilities are, what the actual possibilities are, moment by moment. It's not that we can even know the mind of Buddha. All we can know is the mind that is flowing through us, moment after moment. And keep faith with it. Trust it. And it includes all those things that we think, which includes Buddha mind. That's the shocking thing, in a way, that we find a Buddha mind, even in our foolishness and our badness, our forgetfulness and selfishness. Even so, no, I don't think so. Not usually. He loved playing with his kids. He loved skiing. Those things made him very happy.
He loved that showed. You could obviously tell that.
Yeah.
So he struggled with all of us too.
Yes. Yeah, you could. Yeah, and you could tell when he was having a hard time. He was brokenhearted when he and his wife broke up. He never really got over that. He couldn't believe it in a way that it had happened. And it was so out of his ken that he just never quite accepted it. It was very painful. He felt a very strong calling to be with people and to bring the Dharma to people. But that often meant sitting in the forest around a little fire and just saying hello to whoever came by. He did a lot of that, just being with people wherever he happened to be, which is what Buddha did too. And it's what we do and can do in our life. It isn't anything fancy. I think when we were in the young part of, the early part of being with Kogan, we didn't understand that. We didn't understand hardly anything. We didn't know his needs. Nobody thought to, a lot of people never thought to, that he might need money. They would just come to the Zendo and sit with him and have breakfast with him and have a great time and bring their friends, but it was hard to get enough support for him, for people to realize that he was, you know, had human needs. He wasn't just this fabulous teacher. He was living on our level as well. It took the fierce women to start the whole ball rolling as well as about taking care of him. Sonia especially.
The reason I ask is, you know, as young, whatever you call us, when you're trying to do this, you don't look up to the teacher, but you kind of do. You know, it's your own responsibility, but something in the Bible about talking about the fruit of the Spirit, which is kind of studying the Word.
Mm-hmm.
And when you kind of get it, you can't but let it be in your life, have it show.
Yes.
And and I think this is what kind of makes it similar to the teacher. It shows, you almost don't even have to say anything. And I just wonder about him and not necessarily if somebody struggles and there isn't fruit of the Spirit doesn't mean you're not a good teacher, because who knows what he's been given to deal with as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, life is hard. Now, Buddha had a hard time too. He had a cousin who tried to kill him. He ran into his best friend's son, killed him. It was a very rough world that he lived in. And a lot of difficulty that he went through. He got some support, but he got a lot of no support also. And the Sangha was large enough that it became kind of contentious, and there were times when he just took off and didn't want to see anybody anymore because it was just too, people were arguing with each other and trying to, you know, take over, and he just didn't want any part of that. So even he. and even we. In one way or another, we all have to live life as it is, even though we think of the Garden of Eden and how it must have been. But I think that's part of the human mind, is casting back to a presumed perfection that we wish for, but it's not true in that way that we wish for. We're already there. You know, this is the Garden of Eden. Well, this bodhicitta is called the ultimate bodhicitta. I'm not quite sure why it's called the ultimate, but it's separating the ultimate from the relative. So it's what we call the two truths, the absolute and the relative. The absolute meaning it, all of it, the no separation, and the relative meaning everything in little bits and pieces, the individuality of life as we perceive it and experience it. So that aspect of it is another point. It's the second paramita, which Chogyam calls discipline, which we usually call the precepts or virtue. And keeping the precepts is another way of understanding and expressing and enacting self and other, the interchangeability of self and other. If we do see that there is separation, that we are in bits and pieces, we have to also see that it is all connected at the same time. So the ultimate sees and is able to express the oneness of things by generosity, by acknowledging that I and you, there's no difference. So if I have something and you want it, it's easy, it's yours, because it is yours, and vice versa. In the relative, it's even more intimate, that it's you and me. It's you and me and us, and how we're able to live together. It's recognizing that it is not easy to live together, and that we need help. And the help is the principles that arise in us, as you could say, our very best self. The goodness that's what carries us through our life, really in spite of everything, you could say. So that's the second he says it's learning to love each other. And the way to love each other is to be open to each other, to listen, to become familiar, too, in his example, which is very Tibetan, to see each one that we meet as having been our mother. And as he points out, in the West, there's problems with that, because our experience of parent and parent and child has been quite different in the Western experience for many people. That in some way the parental position of overwhelming caretaking, you could say, the kindness and putting the child first and self-sacrifice in every way, that often our experience of mother isn't quite so simple. But we can imagine and do imagine that there is that basic motherness that we all have, men and women. We all have this mother nature in us that is the basis of love. It's not the throbbing heart or the singing violins. It's the grubby business of life and how to help. How to change, as he says, how to change a dirty diaper. That's love. Willing to do the, to see no separation. So, we've studied the precepts many, many times, and this is another way of looking at and experiencing the precepts as part of these slogans. And coming under that point, training in bodhicitta, is then the slogans that begin. So the second slogan, the first slogan is the point of training in bodhicitta. So just being willing to look at this business of love, generosity, discipline. It says, regard all dharmas as dreams, is the second one. And the third one, which goes with it, is examine the nature of unborn awareness. So this is an invitation to ask, "What? Who is this? What is this when it says me? What is this person that has a name? Can be seen in a mirror, but can't see itself. That's very strange. So if you realize that our existence is a product of our mind encountering something, our existence is the something that we encounter. So we aren't anything until we are everything. So this is an invitation to really look carefully at how you experience yourself, how you understand yourself. It's called unborn awareness in this slogan. Because we don't know where our thoughts are coming from. They're not born anywhere. They just appear. Our thoughts, our experiences show up. So to make a study of that, how this is happening, who this is happening as, that's our next challenge for this next week. Just make a quiet study of what this feels like. And in terms of the awakening of the mind, what do we wake up to? Bodhicitta, waking up. So he says about this being dreams, that whatever you experience in your life, pain, pleasure, happiness, sadness, grossness, refinement, sophistication, crudeness, heat, cold, or whatever, is purely memory. Whatever we experience, and those experiences all our input. It's how we feel what the cold or the heat. It means that although you might think that things are very solid, the way you perceive them is soft and dreamlike. Just feels solid, but reality, it's not that way. What you perceive is a product of your mind, using your sense organs as channels for the sense perceptions. So we're taking it in, continually taking it in, information. Things are taking form as we experience. And then, of course, we are a sender as well as a receiver. We are sending at the same time, receiving, and then becoming something to receive to others. So then examining, when you look at your own mind, he says, which you actually cannot do, but you pretend to do it, you find that there's nothing there. You begin to realize there is nothing to hold on to. Mind is unborn, but at the same time, it's awareness because you still perceive things. There is awareness and clarity. So contemplate that by seeing who is actually perceiving dharmas, contemplate that by seeing who is actually perceiving dharmas as dreams. So look. Keep looking. And make that your week's adventure. Are there questions? Well, it's 8, so we should stop.